सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. Repeat after me. Vasudevendra yogindram Vasudevendra yogindram Natva jnana pradam gurum Natva jnana pradam gurum Mumukshu nam hitarthaya Mumukshu nam hitarthaya Tattva bodho bhidhiyate Tvabodhobhidhiyate Atma kaha Atma kaha Stula sukshma karna sharirat Stula sukshma karna sharirat Yatiriktaha Vyatiriktaha Panchakosha atitaha Panchakosha atitaha sanna sanna avastatraya sakshi avastatraya sakshi satchidananda swarupaha satchidananda swarupaha sanna sanna yastishthati yastishthati Sa Atma, Sa Atma. As we've seen, there are only two things in this world, me and everything else, Atma and Anatma. Bhagavan Sri Krishna in the 13th chapter says, Idam shariram kaunteya kshetram itya vidhiyate etatyo vetitam prahuhu kshetrajnaha iti tad He starts off with this investigation of the body and the knower of the body. The kshetram, the field, is a shariram, and the kshetrajnaha is the one who knows the kshetra, the field, the body. Technically, this anatma and atma, this not me and the me, can be looked at as Idam pratyaya vishaya and aham pratyaya vishaya. Idam pratyaya vishaya and aham pratyaya vishaya. Idam means this. Idam pratyaya means this notion, the thought of this. When we identify something, we say this table. This table, when I have that cognition, part of that cognition is the this part, this table. So the vishaya, the object of the idam pratyaya, the object of the this thought, is the idam pratyaya vishaya, like the table. There's aham pratyaya vishaya, the thing upon which the aham pratyaya, the I thought, aham means I, pratyaya means a chitta vritti, a mental modification, a thought. It's where the I lands. Idam, this, and I. Idam pratyaya, aham pratyaya. And this entire world can be subsumed by those two things. And in every cognition, there is this thought, this table, this chair, and there's this I, who is the perceiver of the this. There's anatma, there's the this, idam, and there's the atma, there's the I, the one who sees it. Sanskrit's a beautiful language. We have two pronouns. We're the first person, the second person, but for third person pronouns, neuter, we have this. And we have this for something close and that, the word that, for something farther away. Sanskrit actually has four. Etat is something that's very close. Idam is something that's fairly close. Adaha is something that is farther away. And tat is something that is paroksha, that is beyond the eyes, that you can't even see. It's beautiful that they have four different third-person pronouns. Idam pratyaya and aham pratyaya. Where does that line exist between the I and the not I. When I say this table, no problem. There's no confusion. When I say this body, it's a whole different matter because the epidermis, our skin, seems to be the dividing line. So because there is this confusion, the author begins with the reply to the question, Atma Kaha, what is the Atma? He says, Stula Sukshma Karna Sharirat Vyatiriktaha. The Atma, Yaha Tishtati Sa Atma, that which remains, that which abides separate, Vyatiriktaha, from the Stula Sukshma and Karna Sharira. So what he's doing is, he's challenging us to question where we draw the line between the Idam and the Aham. Where do we place that idam pratyaya? When we look at something, is that an idam pratyaya? Is that an idam? Is that as this? Or is that an I? We're looking at the gross physical body, the tangible body, the stula sharira. So there's three bodies being described here, the stula, sukshma, and karana sharira. So aham, I, atma, is stula sharira vyatiriktaha, sukshma sharira vyatiriktaha, and karana sharira vyatiriktaha. I am separate from the physical body. That moves that line quite a bit. That moves that line from this table, I am the body, I'm sitting at this table, to I am the perceiver of this body. There's this body, and then there's me. And that draws the line between me and the stula sharira. And that me, who inhabits the stula sharira, can be looked at as the sukshma and karana sharira. I inhabit this physical body. Who inhabits it? Well, I do. Well, what do you mean by I? And he's going to unpack all this in great detail just in the next sentence, if we ever get to it. We will, I promise. So now we've drawn the line. If you say that aham, I, atma, is stula sharirat vyatiriktaha, I'm separate from the physical body, then that draws the line somewhere between an inhabitor and the inhabited. I inhabit this body. But then he says, sukshma sharirat vyatiriktaha, I am separate, the atma is separate from the sukshma, the subtle body. And what is that? That is the mind, the senses, the pranas. We'll talk about that in a moment. So I need to relegate this physical body into the world of physical stuff. This physical body is a physical thing made of physical matter. And it's enlivened. It's enlivened by me. What is it enlivened by? It's enlivened by the sukshma sharira. It's a sukshma sharira that enlivens this body. So I inhabit this physical body. When the sukshma sharira goes, we have a dead body. But I'm separate even from that. What's this enlivening force? Again, we'll go into detail, but it's the systems, circulation, digestion, nervous system, it's all the breath, it's all these systems that enliven this body. It's the sense capacities, it's the capacity to do things, it's the thinking, it's the emotion, it's decisions, it's indecision, it's the subconscious, it's memories. It's the buddhi, it's the intellect, it's the ignorance, it's the I thought. This is all the sukshma sharira. It's the internal subtle stuff that goes on inside, what we think of going on as inside this body. But that isn't you. What do you mean that's not me? That stuff, the capacity to sense, the thoughts that flow by, the decisions you make, the feelings of sukha and dukkha and everything in between, that you have, the pleasant and unpleasant feelings, the cognitions you have, the memories you have, the anxiety you have, the inner child that you have, everything that goes on internally that moves through your inner environment, your inner space, is idam. It's not a hum, it's idam. This thought, this feeling, this emotion, this sense capacity, this sensation, it's all idam. It's quite a challenge to make that move in, to identify the internal stuff as idam rather than me. And even the karana sharira, what we experience in deep sleep, even our most blissful or ignorant experiences too, is this, it's not I. And this model, this three-body model, is presented in a different way as the Panchakoshas. There's not eight things. There's just a different view. Like, we can look at this class as people who live in the United States and people who live in India. We can divide this class into male and female. We can divide this class into people who are below 50 years old and over 50 years old. But it's the same group. It's just looked at from a different way. So we can look at this a different way as five levels of potential misidentification called koshas, sheaths. Again, the problem with the notion of sheath is that a scabbard covers the sword that's put in the sheath. Atma, I am never covered. I am never covered by anything. Nothing. And that's why I can mistake myself to be the body, because I am present in this body. I am present in the sukshma sharira. I am present in the stula sharira and the karna sharira. I'm always available for this mistake to take myself to be the annamaya kosha, the first of the five, which correlates with the stula sharira, the pranamaya, manomaya, vijnanamaya koshas, which correlate to the sukshma sharira, and then the anandamaya kosha, which correlates to the karana sharira. And I am the sakshi of astatraya, of all these three states. I am not the awaker, the dreamer, the sleeper. I don't know if there's such a word, awaker. I am the I am the one who sees. I am the consciousness in the sakshi, which witnesses those three states. And at each of these methods of investigation, I'm redrawing that line between idam pratyaya vishaya and aham pratyaya vishaya, between this thought object and the I thought object, if you will. I'm not an object of thought, but I have an I thought. And what the I thought references becomes subtler and subtler and subtler, until all we've done is we've corrected these mistakes. I am none of these. We've seen this before in story form. Do you remember our 10th man? Remember our 10th man story? These boys are sent on a mission. They cross a river. They think one of them has been drowned in the river. They count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Ah, there are only 9 of us. We were 10 to begin with. Oh my, oh my. The agony. The samsara. Until a wise person with a little smile on his face sees what's going on and says, don't worry, you don't have a problem. I can find you the 10th man right now. They're all relieved. There's a promise, there's a hope, there's a trust in his words, and there's a relief. And they become jignasus. They all want to know. They want to know where their freedom from this anxiety, this sorrow, this dukkha, where does that freedom lie? And he says, I can produce, this wise man says, I can produce this. I can remove your misery in an instant, and I show you the 10th man. So what he does, he's lined all the boys up, and he has the leader count them out. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. What is he doing there? Then he points to the 10th man and says, Tattvamasi, you are the 10th man. Dashamaha Naraha Asi. Dashamaha Naraha Asi. Tvam, you are the 10th man. But before he makes that statement, before he he reveals that, he has him count out Neti, 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 Neti. The 10th man is not Devadatta. The 10th man is not Yajnadatta. The 10th man is not Gurudatta. Not that, not that, not that, not that. And that's what we're doing here. The Atma is not the Stula Sharira. The Atma is not the Sukshma Sharira. The Atma is not the Karana Sharira. Not that, not that, not that, not that. And what that does is create the context where you're backed into a corner and you ask, well, tell me, Atma Kaha, what is this Atma? If it's none of this, what is it? And that's the purpose of these negating sentences. Notice you're saying that I am not the Stula Sharira. You're making no statement at this time about the reality of the Stula Sharira. You're not saying that the Stula Sharira is not you. You're not saying that the gross, subtle, or causal bodies, you're not saying where their reality lies. You're not saying that they're not you. You're saying that you are not them. Just like the gold ornament. right? When you say that the gold is not the bangle, the gold is not the ring, the gold is not the necklace, you're not saying that the reality of the necklace and the ring and the bangle, you're not saying that their reality does not resolve into gold. I haven't gone there yet. But you are saying that gold is not defined by any of those names or forms. Same here. We could easily confuse gold with a bangle because the bangle is not separate from gold. Mithya does not hide satyam. And it's something that has an apparent reality, a dependent reality, does not hide its adhishtana, the thing that is its basis. And that's what allows us to be confused about this body, because I am not absent from this body, but I am not this body. This body depends on me. And that will become clearer as time goes on. This whole neti-neti process is an attempt to uproot this dehatma buddhi, this notion, this buddhi, this conviction that deha-atma asti, that this body is the self. And when we mean this body, we mean all three of those bodies, all five of those koshas, all three of those states. It's to uproot that notion that is held so dearly and so closely and we're just so habituated to. So then after we do that, context creating, after the wise man points out the 10th man is not the first boy, the second boy, the third boy, etc., then we have a positive statement. Satchidananda swarupaha. And this is a definition, if you will. Defining the limitless is a very tricky thing. And we will talk about, when we talk about the process of the Mahavakyas, how the Mahavakyas reveal through not using the primary meaning, but the implied meaning of a word. The lakshartha, not the vachartha, the lakshartha, the implied meaning of each of the words in, the sentence tattvamasi, that's how these statements reveal the truth of yourself. And you can call it a definition, but really, I mean, you can't define the limitless. And yet we have these words which reveal the nature. They're not adjectives. Sat, chit, ananda are not adjectives to myself. I am not a thing which enjoys existence, which enjoys consciousness, and which enjoys ananda. I am. These three things are exactly the same, but they're seen from different perspectives. Sat, existence, is consciousness, and consciousness is ananta, ananda, limitless. And existence is limitless, and that is me. The problem is that we have to use words that we know, and every word that we know points to a limited thing. So how do we define an unlimited thing with words that we know to point to only limited things? We can't use words we don't know, because no knowledge is created to that. If I say the monokoti is identical to the lipsudasu, you would say, huh? Because those words have no meaning. We have to use words that we know. But everything we know, everything we know tends to be not I and tends to be limited. But this definition we do try to convey should be free from defects. And so it should point to the object. For example, if you said a human is an insect the size of a mosquito, that would just be plain incorrect. There are three doshas, three problems, three faults when it comes to definitions. One is asambhava dosha, something, a definition that's not possible. It just misses the mark. It doesn't really define the object. Another one is ativyapti dosha, one that is ativyapti. Vyapti means extensive. Ati means too extensive. So when you say a human is a living being, that's not incorrect, but it's overextended. Because there are other living beings that are not humans. And then there's the avyapti, one in which the definition is not pervasive enough. Avyapti, of yapti. It's not pervasive enough. It doesn't cover enough material. If you said a human being is a woman, again, that's not incorrect, but a human being is also a man. So these problems of a definition are a sambhava dosha, one that is not accurate, one that is too extensive, ativyapti dosha, and one that is not comprehensive enough, which is avyapti dosha. And so in attempting to point to the truth of this Atma, which we've revealed as not being, we've indicated as not being all this, the Shastra says, and therefore this Tattva Bodha says, Sat Chit Ananda Swarupaha Atma. Atma Sat Swarupaha, Atma Chit Swarupaha, Atma Ananda Swarupaha. There's four words. Sat, existence. Chit, consciousness. Ananda, happiness or limitlessness. Swarupaha, the very nature. So I am that whose very nature is consciousness, existence, and limitlessness. Again, it's not an attribute, and it's not really an essence. When you say swarupaha, there's two words that are used in Sanskrit for nature. One is swabhava, which means, oh, it's its nature to be cranky in the morning. That is not a swarupa definition. That is his nature, that's his tendency. That's an incidental property. It's the swarupa of fire to be hot. It's a swarupa of water to be wet. H2O is the swarupa of water. It's its very nature. It's its very thingness. It's a thing that makes it what it is. It's the swabhava of water to be frothy when it's stirred up. That's not the swarupa. That is an incidental property that comes and goes. If we say essence tends to be more ephemeral, like, oh, it's not, you have a substance that has an essence that is very, that can evaporate quickly. That is not the real thing. It's not the vastu. It's not the substantive. When we say essence, it can mean the very core, but it tends not to convey the right meaning. So swarupa, when we mean swarupa, it's the very thing. It's the very nature. So Atma's very swarupa is Sat Chit Ananda. So what does it mean that I am Sat Chit Ananda? Why does he point this out? He points this out because we take ourselves to be mortal. We take ourselves to be ignorant, and we take ourselves to be unhappy. I cannot be mortal if I'm existence itself. I cannot be unhappy if I'm Ananda, limitless, the truth of all happy experiences myself. And I can't be ignorant if I am consciousness itself. And these are three of our fundamental issues that we're always grappling with. So we saw last week the materialistic and the spiritual view of consciousness. Spiritual view is wherein we are inherently a conscious being, incidentally incarnated, and a materialistic view wherein consciousness is an epiphenomenon of physical existence. How do I know I'm chit? How do I know I'm conscious? We take ourselves to be sentient, chaitana. But that which makes us sentient is chaitanya, is consciousness itself. And the sentiency we experience in this sthula sharira, in this physical body, is due to the presence of the sukshma sharira. The sukshma sharira, which we'll see, is sort of the link between the conscious atma, its reflective substance. And in this model that we'll talk about, the Mahabhuta, the five basic element model, it talks about how this subtle stuff of the sukshma sharira is able to reflect consciousness from one perspective. And it's this sukshma sharira that enlivens this gross physical body. But I take myself to be a conscious being. We mistake this consciousness that's reflected in this body as myself, the consciousness that is anupati, that is borrowed from me, that reflects in the mind. We take that to be myself. But still, when you ask somebody, are you a conscious being? You'll say, yes, I am a conscious being. And I am a conscious being while I'm awake. I am a conscious being while I'm dreaming. I am a conscious being while I'm sleeping. And these three states are mutually exclusive. And yet the conscious being, I, am there within the three states. And it never goes away. It never goes away. I remember I must have been a precocious kid. I remember when I was a kid, I don't know how old, 9 maybe, I looked in the mirror and I thought, you know, I don't really have to worry because whenever I look in the mirror, even 30 years from now, I will always still be looking back at myself. And it's true. 30, 40 years later, whenever I look in the mirror, I'm still the one looking back at myself. The body has undergone these decada, these changes. The mind has undergone these changes. The emotions, the intellect, all of this has undergone so many changes, but I am still that one who was that little boy. I was the one who was the adolescent and the grown-up and am now a few years, a few years older. And so that consciousness is constant throughout our experience. It's present in every experience, and it's a constant throughout the aging process. It is the I that never goes. I never cease to be, and consciousness never ceases to be my very nature. Fire never ceases to be hot. Water never ceases to be wet as a liquid. Consciousness is not an attribute of me, because an attribute can come and go. You can have a fresh flower, you can have a withering flower. You can't have dry water. You can't have an inert me. Our experience is that we are never not conscious. But even logically, you can never prove that I am not conscious. You can never prove the absence of consciousness. The absence of consciousness can never be established, because to establish a fact, you need evidence. If I said that Mars was the size of a pebble, you could contradict me because there's evidence that that is not the case. If I said the planet Xenon is the size of a pebble, how would you know? You have no evidence. How do I know there's a planet Xenon? I have no pramana for that. I cannot say that that exists because I have no means of knowledge for it. I have no evidence. Something has to become evident to me that so I can affirm that it exists. So if I need evidence that something is, I need a means of knowledge to give me that evidence, to give me that knowledge. And whenever there's a pramana, a means of knowledge, and a prameya, an object of knowledge, there has to be a pramata, a knower. And that knower has to be conscious. There's no way you can prove that I, Atma, is ever not conscious. The absence of consciousness can never be established, because it always takes someone to establish that fact, and that someone is a conscious being. Consciousness is self-expressing, self-shining. It's a self-evident fact. Consciousness is always in every experience. You can't get rid of consciousness. You can get rid of the body in meditation. You can get rid of the mind. You can get rid of all this. You cannot get rid of consciousness. Just try. I dare you. Just try. You cannot get rid of consciousness. So if you can't get rid of consciousness, what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of its ontology, in terms of its existence? Trikalebi tishtati satyam. That which exists in the past, present, and future can be called sat, can be called satyam. That which never was not, and that which never will not be, that which always is sat, is existence, is just existence. We attribute existence to all these things, but really existence is unchanging. Existence never is not. Consciousness never is not. Consciousness is always present. It was present in all of our past experiences. It will be present in all of our future experiences. That which always is existence. Consciousness is not separate from existence. There's not two different things. The thing that exists is consciousness. And consciousness is not different than existence. We attribute existence to everything in our experience. We see the table exists, the chair exists, this body exists, this thought exists. Is. This is. In every cognition, in every idam pratyaya, in every thought of this is, the commonality is the isness, is the asti. This is. And that isness doesn't change. We say that this is an existent table. This is not an existent table. It's like saying this is a wooden table. Wood is not the attribute of a table. The table is just a name and form. Wood is the substance. It's much more like there's a tabley wood than there is a wooden table. So too with existence. This is not an existent table. This is a tabley existence because there is no table there. The table is mithya. The table can be reduced into wood, which can be reduced into planks, which can be reduced into fibers, which can be reduced into cells and molecules and atoms. There is nothing there that's really table. It's a convenient function. It's mithya. It is adhishtana ananya. It is not separate from its substance. And the only substance we can find there is sat, is existence. So our entire experience of everything is an experience of things that exist. But the existence is not an attribute of anything. The existence is the thing. And in that cognition is that idam pratyaya, and that astitvam, the isness that is in that idam pratyaya, that this thought, this is, that's sat. And that sat is the consciousness which is in every cognition, which is necessary in every cognition. This mind takes on the form of objects. This consciousness, which is existence, lends its existence to all of our experience because I is consciousness and am not different from existence. There's a lot there. We'll talk more about that later and maybe I'll be able to explain it more clearly. The Kena says, Pratibodha Vidita Matam, consciousness is in every cognition as consciousness and existence. And I am the truth of every moment. And the only thing that exists in every moment, I exist now. Where's the past? Where's the future? What time frame do we use to define now? Do we use a decade, a year, a month, a week, a day, an hour, a minute, a second, a microsecond, a nanosecond, a picosecond? Is that the order? The truth of any unit of time is now. And the only thing that we can say that is conscious existence right now. I am the truth of time. Time is infinitely divisible, but there is a presence in the present moment, and that is I. I am free of time. Consciousness and existence are free of time. Time is a concept of which I am aware. I am not bound by time. Things that are time-bound are objects of my awareness. As I said in meditation, if I am not this body, where is my mortality? If I am this mind, then I die every second. These thoughts are just moving so quickly. If I am these thoughts, then I am dying and being reborn every second. But I'm not. I see the flow of thoughts. I see this movement of the mind. Anything that's time-bound, the mind, the body, is an object of my awareness, as is time. Sat-chit ananda. This ananda can be looked in two different ways. Ananda, often it is translated as happiness. And the problem with translating ananda as happiness, well, it's not just happiness, right? When you read these books, when you read translation, they say, oh, it's not just happiness, it's bliss. And it's not just bliss, it's bliss with a capital B, because it has to be the most happy experience that you can actually think of. But if I am a state of bliss, I come and go, because states by definition come and go. So why do we use the term ananda? I am very comfortable with happiness. Happiness seems to be natural to me. I don't push away happiness. I push away unhappiness. Unhappiness does not seem to be natural to me. Unhappiness seems to be something I want to change. I am not comfortable. I am not at home. When I'm happy and the mind resolves, when I demand nothing of the world, including this body and mind, I am content. I am at peace. I am with myself. I am a non-wanting person. And in that, I find fullness, completeness. I stop my search. I stop my search when I'm happy. I stop my search when the duality between the seeker and the sought resolve. I stop my search when my mind quiets in a sunset. Happiness is natural to me. Happiness is my nature. But there is Swarupananda and Vrittiananda. There's Anubhutananda or Vrittiananda. Anubhuta means experienced happiness. Vritti means a chitta vritti, a thought form. These are temporary. The sukha vritti, this happy thought, comes and goes. Happy thought, neutral thought, sad thought, happy thought, neutral thought, happy thought, happy thought, happy thought, neutral thought, sad thought. There's apparently a pitch associated. Apparently a sukha vritti, a happy thought, has a higher pitch than a dukkha vritti, which is very serious and problematic. Those thoughts come and go, come and go, come and go. If I am that sukha vritti, that happy thought, then I come and go. My state comes and goes, and that's not true. You can look at a sukha vritti as one which more fully reflects, more fully reveals, that doesn't hide my nature. My nature, which is complete at-homeness. And I can be happy for no reason. I can be happy in the presence of hundreds of outstanding desires. I can be happy in deep sleep. We all go to deep sleep and we love it. We all love deep sleep. Oh, I didn't sleep very well. I'm not very happy. It wasn't a very happy experience. Because that happiness is natural to us. And it's not a vritti ananda. It's not a capital B, because if we continue to search for this big B bliss ananda, we'll forever be searching, because we're trying to become something other than what I am. What I need to do is understand that I am the truth of any happy experience. I am the truth of any bliss experience. When you have a deep meditation experience, when you sing bhajans and all there is your devotion to the Lord, when you do puja, when you have any, what we used to call being blissed out, when you get blissed out for any reason, if you have those experiences. The truth of that vritti, that the truth of that experience is me, but that experience is not the truth of me. I am the experiencer in that ananda vritti, and that does not hide the truth of myself. But my goal is to not come up with more and more blissful experiences. My task as a mumukshu is to recognize that I am really a jignasu. One who desires freedom is one who desires knowledge. And one who desires knowledge desires the knowledge of the nature of myself, which is the truth of every happy experience. It's not the happy experience. I'm not a sukhi. If I'm a sukhi, then I can be a dukhi. If I'm one who experiences happiness, I'm one who can experience sorrow. And so we use this term ananda because that's what we're searching for. In all these pursuits and in all the other purusharthas, kama, artha, and dharma, what we're pursuing is this ananda, is this happiness, is this sense of being at home. And the sense of being at home is gifted to us by Mother Shruti with the knowledge that I am what it is I seek. Tattvam asi. You are the tenth man. And there is a related phrase in the Taittiriya Upanishad that correlates to this Satchit Ananda. Shankaracharya writes these wonderful commentaries in the Taittiriya Upanishad where it says, Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma. Brahma, the truth of the world, is Satyam Jnanam Anantam, which correlates to Satchit Ananda. Satyam, truth, is Sat, is existence. Jnanam, knowledge, is Chit, correlates to Chit, consciousness. And there's so much discussion around this. It's just so beautiful, because what we say is sat, is truth, is only a relative notion. We need to dig in and investigate into really what that existence of anything is. That's when satyam is revealed. So we look at jnanam, knowledge, samvit, is just consciousness, because the truth of the knower and the truth of knowledge and the truth of the known resolve into consciousness. So much to be said there. Anantam, and that correlates with ananda. So ananta means endless. Anta means end, like Vedanta means Vedanam antaha, the end of the Vedas. Anta means end. Ananta means endless, having no end, limitless. And so it's often much more useful to talk about ananda as ananta, because they correlate one-to-one, satyam, jnanam, anantam, satchit, ananda. And that limitlessness is purnatvam. There's a root dhatu, Sanskrit root purn, which means to fill. The past passive participle of pur is purna. It means filled, totally filled. Swamiji talks about if you have a cup of water and you can fill it to the top and then you fill it a little bit more, where there's a tension of the surface of the water that allows it to bulge over the lip just a little bit, that's purnatvam. That's lacking nothing. That is completeness. That is seeing that I am the whole. This existence is limitless. There is no limit to it. Anything that appears to limit existence, this existent table, oh, this existence is limited by the table. No, it's not. That table just temporarily enjoys the ability to call itself existent. The existence is not limited at all by that table. It's not limited by any object. So too consciousness. If consciousness is existence, and existence is not limited, it's ananta, then that means I am limitless. I am not bound by these objects in the world, and this idam, these objects in this world, include this body, these senses, this thought, this mind. All of this is mithya. All of this idam pratyaya vishaya. All of these idam pratyaya vishayas are mithya. They're not inherently substantial. And that is what allows aham to be ananta. That's what allows I, this atma, to be called ananta, to be limitless, because it is the only vastu. I am the only vastu. That's why I mentioned in our discussion earlier today about meditation. If I see that I am the only vastu here, I am the only substance here, I am the cause of this entire creation, there is no separation between me and Ishvara, between the Lord, then maybe I don't need to meditate. If I don't see that, then I can continue listening and I can continue this nidhyasana. And it takes some time. It takes some time to reorient. How many endless lives have we taken ourselves to be these limited transient things? It takes some time to gain this Vedanta orientation, if you will. And that's why bringing this to mind again and again and again is just so useful. And that's why bringing this to mind, seeing this, whatever little piece grabs you, whatever little piece you go, aha, I see that. And don't let that go when the class goes. Tomorrow morning when you wake up, bring that back to mind. When you walk down the street, when you turn your car on, whenever you do that, you can say, ah, the body, the gunas interact with the gunas. This physical body is turning this physical key. Aham akarta, I am not doing anything. I am the sakshi, if you will, if you want to look at it that way. I am the sakshi of this action that the body is doing. Where am I? You can take any little piece of what the Shastra says and bring that to life during the course of the day to help break us from this habitual, tragic, if you will, maybe too dramatic, too melodramatic of a word, but it is tragic when we think that I am mortal, that I am limited, that I have to pursue, I have to break dharma, I have to do adharmic things even to try to prop myself up, to make myself happy. I am this limited little being when really the Shastra has a completely different vision. A wise man will have this vision of you and he will accommodate your misapprehension of yourself and work within the spheres that you are currently working in.
If you are dealing with sorrow, he will address your sorrow. He will not up-level your sorrow. If you have a death in the family, if you lost your job and you go to a jnani, he's not going to say, ah, don't worry, you're not your role, you're not your body. That wasn't really your mother anyway. No. A jnani, a wise person, will deal with an individual's experience on that level. Again, I refer to this mother, Shruti, how nurturing this teaching is, because it really soothes all of our wounds, because all of our hurts are based on this misidentification and the fact that we're constantly trying to solve this problem in the wrong way. We don't see it. And a jnani will see this about you. A jnani will see you have no problem whatsoever. A jnani will see that you and he or you and she are no different at all. And yet, all of these roles need to be played. So when there's a situation that needs compassion, then a jnani is compassionate. When there's a situation that needs action, then a jnani does things. But he never loses sight that whatever experience that is going on, whatever action that he performs, it's just entertainment. This whole phenomenal creation is just entertainment. Because I have nothing at stake. Even if this body falls, there's this beautiful verse that we'll talk about in this next section that compares this body to a boat and saying, you've spent a lot of capital in punya to get this physical body. Make sure you use it to cross the ocean of samsara before it completely falls apart. So this next sentence here is starting to unpack each of these aspects of the previous sentence. So we have the three bodies, the five koshas, the three states of experience, satchidananda swarupaha atma, those four statements. So now he's taking the stula sharira of the first model. Please note that the tatparya of these models is not to describe the physiology of the body. When you say, oh, there's five elements, oh, there's five pranas, the tatparya, the intention of the shruti, of the shastra, of the texts, of the Vedas, Upanishads, talking about the body is not to reveal medical science to the world. It is to conveniently package up our mistaken notions of self-identity in order to clearly see what I am not. Just note that there are models. If there are better models that you choose to use that are clearer, that work, that's great. These are the ones that have worked since time began. So these are the ones that are presented. So in this model, we start talking about the stula sharira. So repeat after me. Stula shariram kim. Stula shariram kim. Finally, back to the text, huh? We're actually going to go through these next sections fairly quickly. Panchikrita, panchikrita, pancha mahabhutaihi, pancha mahabhutaihi, kritam sat, karma janyam, sukha dukkhadi, bhogayatanam, shariram, asti jayate, vardhate, vardhate, viparinamate, viparinamate, apakshiyate, apakshiyate, vinashyati, vinashyati, shat vikaravat, etat, etat, stula shariram, So now he says, what is kim, the stula sharira? What is this gross physical tangible body? He says several things about it. He says the specific cause, the general cause, the function or purpose, and then the nature or characteristics of this physical body. He says, Panchi Krita Panchamahabhuta Hikritam Sat. That's one. Karma Janyam, that's two. Now, many versions of this text will say Sat Karma Janyam. So there's two readings of this. One is Panchi Krita Panchamahabhuta Hikritam Sat, and a separate phrase, Karma Janyam. Some people put the Sat with karma. We can look at it both ways. And then, so the third phrase is Sukhatugadi Bhoga Ayatanam Shariram, the body. And then the fourth phrase, the fourth attribute is Asti Jayati Varitate Viparinamate Apakshiyate Vinashyati Shat Vikaravat. That's the fourth phrase. Lastly, etat stulam shariram. This, etat, etat. Remember the pronouns I said? Etat, idam, adaha, tat, in order of closeness. This is etat, this very thing that I can touch right here, very, very close to me. This is the stula shariram.
So, panchi krita mahabhutahi kritam sat is what's called the samanya karanam, the general common cause. The karma janyam is the specific cause. Sukhatukadi bhoga ayatanam shariram is the purpose, and its attribute is asti jayati varite viparinamate apakshiyate vinashati. So let's begin this. Panchi krita pancha mahabhutahi kritam sat. Basically, what it's saying here is the shariram, the body, is created by these panchamahabhutas, these five subtle elements. Maha means great. Here they mean the five basic or subtle elements. Panchamahabhutaihi. Mahabhuta is a subtle element, and there are five of them, and this body is sat, is being kritam, created by these five subtle elements, which have undergone a process called panchi karanam. Panchi krita pancha mahabhuta. A lot of punches. So there's a process which we'll talk about called panchi karanam. And something which has undergone this process of panchi karanam is something which has the attribute, the adjective, panchi krita. It has been made five. It has been made tangible. So basically, through this process of quintuplication, they call it, becoming five. Panchikritam literally means becoming five. So when these five subtle elements have become grossified, have become these five physical elements, that is the samanya karana, that is the general cause for this body. This is the stuff that it's made of. Stula in vernacular, the word stula shirira, stula means fat, it means heavy. But it doesn't mean here. It means tangible. It means a physical manifestation. It means available to the senses. He'll give us an opening volley, an initial statement, and then he'll spend some time unpacking that. And then he'll start unpacking what was referenced in the previous sentence. Then he'll unpack that. So it's a gradual dilation of all this terminology that he's using. So we'll talk specifically what these Mahabhutas are and what this process of Panchikaranam is. But basically, the five subtle elements are akasha, space, vayu, air, agni, fire, apaha, the waters, water, it's always plural, and prithvi, earth. Now, these are subtle elements. These are not the physical things, but these are subtle versions of these five elements. There are a lot of fives. There are five elements, five sense capacities, five capacities for action, five koshas, a lot of fives. This five-element model is very comprehensive. And for many of us, it's a beautiful way to look at this whole thing, to package up our entire experience so that we can understand the nature of the Atma, which is the Tatparya, which is the intention of these models. We talk about these five Mahabhutas, these five subtle elements in this order, Akasha, Vayu, Agni, Apa, Prithvi, space, air, fire, water, earth, because this is how it's presented as manifesting, one from another, and it also goes from the most subtle to the most gross. The gross objects made of earth are available to all five senses, whereas those that are made of other combinations of these subtle elements are not available to all five senses. So just note that this order is meaningful and become more meaningful when we unpack this whole srishti prakriya, this whole creation investigation. So this grossification, this quintuplication of these subtle elements, they become these physical tangible elements. And therefore, the body is this physical tangible thing. It is inert. There is no consciousness inherent in this body. It is made of these physical tangible things. And you can say that the shariram, this body is made of carbon, is made of minerals, is made of earth substance. When we say earth, we don't mean the earth as opposed to the moon. We mean minerals and carbon and those sorts of things. So this body we can look at as being made of earth, made of food, which is nothing than a transformation of earth. Water, the body is what, 70% water? Fire, 98.6. We have some heat generating in there. Air, there's oxygen and different gases in the body. And space, the body takes up space and the body has space between the cells, etc. So that's a very simple way to look at this body being a manifestation of the five elements. Karmajanya. Now, karmajanya means born of action. Karma means action. Janya means born. Karma here doesn't mean action. It means karmapala, the result of action. Karma is a very versatile word. Karma can mean the direct object of a verb. Aham palam pashyami, I see the fruit. That palam is a karma. What do you mean palam is a karma? What do you mean a fruit is an action? That doesn't make any sense. No, karma here means the direct object of the verb I see. Karma also means action, but here it means karma pala. It means the result. And this is what is responsible for the specific situations we find ourselves in and the specific attributes of this particular body. For example, when you have a building, the materials can all be the same, but their particular configurations all differ based on what was ordered, right? Somebody orders a 2-bedroom flat with 1 bathroom. Somebody orders a 100-bedroom house with 200 bathrooms. I don't know. The building materials are all going to be sticks and 2x4s and bricks and cement and nails and all that. But the particular configuration is different based on what was ordered. So you can look at this karmapala, results of actions that are in the jiva's account. That is how you order, in a sense, this particular incarnation, the particulars of this body, the particulars of this situation. Because it's based on this premise, is that there is no causeless event. Every event has a cause. An event to which we don't know the cause is called an accident. But every incident, every event has a cause. If we don't know the cause of an incident, we call it an accident. But there is no effect without a cause. And so there is no phenomenon without a cause for that phenomenon. And the nature of the effect is in the cause. Like the seed, the nature of the tree is inherent in the seed. So for every action, there is this model that's presented. There's this model of every action having both a drishta and adrishtapala. Drishtapala means a seen result. Pala means fruit, means a result. Drishta means seen. Adrishta means unseen. So for everything you do, there's a seen result and an unseen result. So let's say someone's walking down the road and I stick my leg out and I trip them. Not a nice thing to do. The seen result, the drishtapala, is that the poor person falls down. The unseen result may contribute to my future experiences. They say that all pleasant experiences are due to punya. All unpleasant experiences I have are due to papam. Punya are the results of actions that have accrued to the individual's karmic account, which contribute to my experiences in this life. And punya is the result of good deeds, those that are in harmony with dharma. And papam is a result of those deeds which are adharmic and those which cause disharmony. And so, again, later on, he'll unpack this karmic model, but there is this reservoir, this bank account in this model that is filled with our adrishtapalam, with the unseen results, and in a sense, the as yet unmanifest results of our past actions. And those are packaged into what is called prarabdha. Prarabdha is the package of karmapala that creates our opportunities and our experiences in this world. And so the particularities of this incarnation, where we're born, who our parents are we rich, are we poor, are we healthy, are we not healthy, are ordered, just as the house was ordered, we're ordered by this particular set of karmas that are packaged in our prarabdha and unfold during the course of this life. And so that's why this body is called karmajanyam. It's born of karmapala. Some people say that this sentence, this phrase is sat karma janya. Sat karma, sat. Sat is a present active participle from the dhatu us, to be. So sat can be the neuter nominative singular, lots of Sanskrit, of the present active participle to be, which basically means being or is. Just like in the previous sentence, we saw the word sun a couple times. Sun, that's the masculine version of sat. The present active participle, nominative singular, masculine is sun, and in neuter, it's sat. Shariram is neuter. So it says sat. Atma, in the previous sentence, is masculine, a masculine noun, so you use the masculine present active participle. So some people say that the sat goes with the previous phrase, which is panchi krita pancha mahabhutahi krita kritam sat. And some people say it goes with a sat karma janyam. And in that case, it would mean that this body is janyam, is born of sat karma, of good karma. Now, when you look at it this way, you can say that it's a very rare occurrence to be born as a human being. It's a rare opportunity that we shouldn't squander. And this rarity should not be squandered because it is in a human birth only that we have the opportunity to gain moksha. All other incarnations, either born as a deva in another world, born as an animal, whatever incarnation you have, it's only in a human birth do you have the opportunity for moksha, for freedom. So it shouldn't be squandered. And so it takes a lot of punya, a lot of good karmapalam to be born as a human being. And so this is said to be a sat karma janya. A human birth is said to be an effect of sat karma, of good previous actions of punya. The problem with that, it's pointed out that this body is actually a result of papam and punya. Our experiences in this life are a result of good actions and bad actions, or favorable and unfavorable results. So those who argue that the sat should be with the previous sentence have a point. It's a avyapti dosha. Remember I talked about the good definition should not be either too narrow or too broad? This is avyapti. It doesn't account for the fact that it's also asat karmajanya. This human body is also a result of papam as well. So we saw the first two statements about this gross body. Panchi krita pancha maha bhutahi kritam sat karma janyam. And we will see next time we meet the rest of this definition of the stula sharira. Let's take just a moment. Om swasti prajabhyah paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha Bro Brahmane Vyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshati Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamcho Barahitaha Brahmana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma kashchit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amrtangamaya om purnamadah purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vishishyate om shanti shanti shantihi Harihi Om Sri Gurubhyo Namaha. Harihi Om. Om. I didn't hear your chanting, Jayaraman, of the Swasti Prajabhyaha, but I'm sure it was perfect.
No, I do it at least twice every day.
Oh, wonderful. It's a beautiful prayer.
Once after my meditation and once before sleeping.
Oh, excellent. That's one thing we went over in Mysore.
Correct. We love that. We love that chant.
It's beautiful. It's a universal peace prayer. What can go wrong?
In fact, I was telling my wife the other day, which religion gives you such a beautiful prayer? Mm. I mean, you're not asking anything for yourself. Mm-hmm. You're asking everything for the others, for the world at large.
Yes.
I mean, this is simply so elevating. I think absolutely elevating.
Isn't it so selfless, so beautiful?
Beautiful, yes.
And universal.
Absolutely.
Well, you do ask asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityor ma amrtangamaya. But what else is there to ask for? So you're basically asking for moksha. So one characteristic, Swami Paramarthananda has mnemonics. And one mnemonic for how one simplifies one's life is an attribute of inner sannyasa, inner renunciation. Mm-hmm. Whether you're a physical sannyasi or not, he has this mnemonic clasp, which I think stands for claiming the body and possessions as oneself. That's one thing that you give up when you're a sannyasi, and one thing you give up if you have antara sannyasa, inner sannyasa, is claiming this body, this abhimana, this claiming this identity or possession of this body or objects or relationships. Another thing you give up is anxiety, because if you have the sense of ownership, possession, identity with anything in this creation, you have anxiety about it because you need to acquire them and you need to maintain them and retain them. And the last thing he says to give up, which is curious, he says, you give up the CLASP, and he says special prayers. You give up special prayers. When you're a sannyasi, you don't pray for, dear Santa, please bring me a sled and bring me a new bicycle. You know, you don't have these prayers because you've given up ownership and identity with everything. So the only thing you can pray for is freedom, is moksha. And may everyone be happy. May everybody be free. May everybody be free from sorrow, from sickness, etc. So that is the prayer of a jnani. May everyone be happy. May everyone be free. May everybody have auspicious things in their lives. And may we have moksha.
Actually, I had a question, and I might have asked this question before, and you might have answered it, and I've already forgotten. So let me ask you again. So essentially, you covered briefly, or maybe to some extent, on consciousness.
Yes.
If I understand you right, you said consciousness is the truth, right? It's satyam.
Yes.
Okay. And then if consciousness is permanent and is always ever-pervading, and the human body takes various rupams, so to speak, and I, after my birth, start to appreciate consciousness after some number of years, and then once we all die, body leaves consciousness. So isn't it true that when you say I, it's to some extent the body that is kind of like intercepting, even if consciousness is like infinity and is ever present, it's the body that kind of like the body and the mind, the brain, so to speak, is interpreting it the time you're alive, which essentially means I is still restricted to appreciating the consciousness while you're alive. Maybe I'm breaking all the principles here, but...
No. I think I get what you're saying. The last sentence is true. The last sentence, which is, you need to be alive to appreciate that I'm conscious, consciousness. The models that are presented are that it's the expression of consciousness through the presence of the sukshma sharira, the subtle body. It's the presence of the sukshma sharira that allows for the expression of consciousness in the stula sharira. So the sukshma sharira, the subtle body, is that which enlivens this physical body, and is that which goes, and that's that which transmigrates. And it's made up primarily of sattva guna, and we'll talk about sattva guna, the three gunas, but this mind stuff, if you will, is primarily sattva guna, and it has the capacity to reflect consciousness. That's why the moon appears to be bright, because it reflects the sunlight. So this mind manifests consciousness. Another way to say it is that it reflects consciousness, and it's in this reflected consciousness, in this reflecting material, that this mind appears to be sentient and that this body appears to be sentient, and that the form that intelligence takes, the form that consciousness expresses, is a function of the stula sharira, is a function of the body. You're not going to have the sukshma sharira of a elephant in a mosquito body. We love anthropomorphizing animals. That's what all these cartoons are about. A lot of these cartoons are these little human beings in the form of monkeys and penguins and all that. But the expression of the sukshma sharira is in keeping with the stula sharira. So a monkey will have a monkey brain, and that brain, that upadhi, what's called an upadhi, will control the expression of the sukshma sharira. So the only thoughts, subtle thoughts, the only thoughts that a monkey will have are monkey thoughts. And the human will have human thoughts and the expression of humanity, of human feelings and thoughts. But what leaves the body at the time of death is the sukshma sharira taking the capacity of the body to reflect sentiency, to reflect consciousness with it. So ask your question again, because I'm not sure I answered that question.
No, I mean, I was just contemplating that when we say I am consciousness, I'm just thinking I am consciousness only till I'm alive. Consciousness will always be there. Everybody has consciousness. And I'm just taking a 60 years or 100 years of time and like understanding it, appreciating it. I'm a part of consciousness, but am I consciousness? Even if, yeah.
Yeah, so you are nothing but consciousness, but like for a baby, let's say you have an infant. Now, is that conscious or not? Is that baby conscious? Is consciousness expressed in that upadhi? Is that consciousness expressed in that incarnation, in that combination of stula, sukshma, karana, sharira? Yes, there's a sentient being there. Whenever you see sentiency, there's consciousness there. Is that baby self-aware? I am not, as an infant, self-aware, but my self-awareness grows over time. As I mature, I become self-aware. Animals have very limited self-awareness. They have enough to try to keep alive. Some have social systems, which indicates there's a greater sense of kind of self-awareness in their social environment. But a baby has very limited self-awareness. It knows when it's hungry, and it knows when it's sleepy and cranky. So don't confuse self-awareness with consciousness. So you don't really grow in consciousness. It's better to think about it as you growing in that self-awareness. In other words, you're becoming self-reflective. You become capable of pondering yourself as a living conscious being as you grow up. And that comes with time. That comes with an adolescent or adult maturation.
So yeah, maybe in the future classes, I just want to kind of like fully understand, if I say a statement like, I am the truth, what am I referring to here?
Yeah. Well, that is why he's painstakingly going through defining what the physical sukshma, subtle body, the five koshas, the karana sharira, the five koshas, all of this, because we have to create the context to realize that what I am, because we still have a sense. Even though we see this body is an object, we still feel I am this body. Even though we see that the mind's passed by, if you will, passed by my attention, which is a, in a sense a focal point of the mind, which expresses consciousness like a train going past the platform, even though we see this continual train of thoughts, stream of thoughts, I am the subject to those objects, I still take myself to be the mind. We have a lot of work to do to redefine this I thought. Where do we draw that line? And that's what all this investigation and vichara is about. And it takes time to sit with it. And we'll talk more about it. But I've had friends, they've studied Vedanta, and they'd be out there looking at the stars and saying, how can I be all of this? I'm just this little person here. And in the presence of the magnificence of the entirety of the galaxy that we see, it's so awe-inspiring. If I take myself to be at that moment, this, the particularities of this incarnated individual, then of course I'm not all of this. But when we investigate, when we do the vichara, when we do the viveka, I can be this little person looking up at the stars, appreciating the enormity. And that's, I'm a little alpagniha, alpashaktiman. I'm this person with limited knowledge and limited capacity. And this whole world is, universe is so huge. That's the same relationship I have with Ishvara. Ishvara is bigger than the galaxy, right? Ishvara, there's nothing here that isn't currently Ishvara. So I'm this little thing. Bhagawan, the Lord, is all of this. How can I be this cosmos, let alone the Lord? And that's what the investigation of Tattvamasi is. That's where we look at, well, really, what do we mean by we say I? And what do we mean when we say Lord? What do we mean by the identity? And so the I thought has to constantly resolve into who I am fundamentally, not who I am incidentally. And I incidentally enjoy a body. I incidentally enjoy a personality, enjoy certain mental, intellectual capacities, certain sense capacities, certain capacities to create. But these are all incidental to me. And it's not like I don't make use of them. It's not like I don't make use of a pot just because it's made of clay. I don't treat a pot like a dish or a dish like a pot. I work with its functional reality, its yavaharaja satta. I take that as it is and do what I need to do in this world, still knowing that all the pot is and all the dishes and all the cup is clay. So still knowing that I am Satchidananda Swarupaha, I can still as though go about my business. And that as though is very important, because the clay is as though a pot. The clay is existing as though a plate. I am existing as though an individual who plays various roles throughout life. But it's a big transformation of understanding to disentangle me from not me. And that's why we spend so much time on it.
That was a good one, Dakshaji. Now I follow it.